dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week on the program, we heard how resource colonization looks when it comes home, whether it's in the Finger Lakes in New York State or in a village in the Niger Delta. The same dynamics apply. Profit is extracted by multinational corporations through agreements with corrupt government officials at the state or national level, through laws that leave local people virtually powerless to defend their land and way of life. The only way this stops is when people organize to say no and insist on the human right to decide for yourself what happens in the place you live. To mentally decolonize yourself is a prerequisite for taking back your power. The ultimate goal of gaining power is to be able to create a society you want to live in. Congress and the new Obama administration are working feverishly to, as they say, get the economy going again. I can't really blame them, given that most people are trapped in this collapsing structure with no exit nearby. And the corporate influence over all aspects of society and politics results in leaders so indoctrinated that they're incapable of seeing the exit. Unfortunately, they're wasting a lot of time and effort. It should be clear from the material presented on this show that a continuation of business as usual is empirically impossible. Many people are focused also on the money that they're wasting, but to me, that's less important. Money is a figment of our social imagination, created by banks out of thin air and honored by social consensus enshrined in law. We could do away with it instantly and neither have more nor less of the things we need to transform society: ideas, skill, effort, and what the earth provides. This week on the program, we're going to focus on solutions, on developing social systems appropriate both to our needs and our limitations. The ingredients of systemic change will be the topic as we return to material from Confronting the Triple Crisis Conference, held by the International Forum on Globalization in Washington, D.C. in the fall of 2007.
My name is Megan Quinn Bachman. Tonight we have a treat. We're going to be focusing on solutions, on options for engagement and action, things that we can all do. I think it's been made pretty clear over the past couple of days that we really need nothing less than a total transformation of the way that we use energy and fossil fuels and other resources in our society, a fundamental transformation in the way that we live on this planet. And so tonight we're going to be addressing how we can do that. We have with us some of the world's foremost experts on issues of peak fossil fuels, local and ecological economics, sustainable lifestyles, communities, overconsumption, and more. It's a great cross-section we have of both academics and activists. So we'll have a great variety of powerful theories and ideas, as well as ways that we can actually put them into practice. And I think that's extremely important, because I think all of us here can and must get involved in moving what destroys our community, moving from what destroys our communities, our environment, and our future, towards what leads us to a positive, peaceful, sustainable, and more equitable world. We'll hear about ways we can make this transition in our own personal lives, in our local communities, and in the world as a whole. I hope that this panel provides you with some of the inspiration, and the tools that you need in your work. So my organization, Community Solution in Yellow Springs, Ohio, we really view the converging calamities of our time not as problems unto themselves, but as the symptoms of a far greater problem, and that is of our disconnection from each other and from nature. In short, it's a crisis of community. Now, 65 years ago, our founder, Arthur Morgan, foresaw the increasing industrialization and urbanization that fossil fuels have brought us. He saw that this was a dangerous trend leading to environmental destruction, social alienation, and some of the greatest inequities that we've ever seen. So in the latter part of his life, he started preaching the message that only by living interdependently within small local communities can we truly be sustainable, live happier, healthier, and more meaningful lives. So he founded our organization to continue that work, which brings me before you this evening. Now, because trying to define the word community is a lot like trying to define the word love, I'm going to talk about community tonight in mostly practical ways. Now, among many things, community to me is a vision of the future where we're conserving and sharing scarce local resources rather than depleting and destroying seemingly abundant distant resources. It is a vision where we're consuming far fewer resources but have a better life, filled with valued relationships rather than valued possessions. But before we can live locally in community, we have to stop living globally. So the first thing that we have to do is to participate by not participating, to stop contributing to so much global destruction by reducing our consumption of resources, starting with the most destructive, fossil fuels. Now, this is what my organization calls curtailment, and it is the critical first step towards community. So how far do we need to curtail as a society? Well, we've heard many different thoughts on that throughout the day, and I'm just going to provide a quick and easy calculation. The Earth, the land, and oceans, that is, can absorb up to 10 billion tons of carbon dioxide each year. So with anywhere from 6 to 8 billion people on the planet over the next few decades, we'll need to be emitting a maximum of 1 to 2 tons of CO2 per person per year. Well, today, we Americans are now producing 20 tons of CO2 per person per year. Western Europe's at about 10, and the world average is 4. So while everybody needs to reduce their use of fossil fuel energy, we in the United States need somewhere on the order of a 90 to 95% reduction. And we've heard similar figures throughout the day. Now, unfortunately, most of the so-called solutions to the energy and climate crisis are actually making us more dependent upon unsustainable systems and don't get anywhere near this 90 to 95% reduction. These mostly corporate and government solutions serve to placate our fears and keep us complacent and consuming. We're told, of course, that the experts will come up with something to save us, and of course we believe them because it's easier to do so than to change our own habits. But I invite you to ask the question, whose solutions are those? They're not for us. They do not serve us, and they do not empower us, which is very important. That's why we talk about the only solutions that can truly save us from both catastrophic climate change and economic collapse at the end of the era of cheap energy and give us a chance for a more democratic, equitable, and sustainable world are solutions based upon personal and local action to consume less. I'm going to address some of these dangerous false solutions. We heard some earlier today, biofuels and clean coal. But many of these solutions are ironically based upon consuming more resources, and these are the green solutions that you're hearing about a lot from the media and from environmentalist groups. So instead, I'm going to offer some radical curtailment strategies that get closer to that 95% reduction level. I'm also not going to talk about low-hanging fruit tonight. We hear a lot about the top 10 ways that we can save the environment, but it just might be if we added up all the low-hanging fruit, like compact fluorescence and hybrid cars or whatever it may be, we might not get anywhere near that 90 to 95% reduction level. So I'm going to look at places that we're using the most energy so we can make the most impact. And it begins with a look at how we're using energy. Tonight I'm going to look at energy use in the principal areas under direct personal control, and that's housing, food, and transportation. It may surprise you that buildings in the U.S. consume 48% of the total energy. This includes, of course, the construction, demolition, embodied energy, and maintenance of the buildings. Now, this is more than for food or for transportation. Worldwide, though, you hear that familiar quote that the U.S. is producing 27% of the CO2 emissions. Well, buildings in the U.S. generate 42% of the world's CO2 emissions from buildings. And size is a major factor. The average new home in the U.S. is now 2,200 square feet, or 800 square feet per person. In 1950, this was 1,000 square feet, or 300 square feet per person. Compared with Europe and Japan, our houses are about twice as large and are consuming 2.5 times the energy. But the dominant solution that we hear for buildings today is so-called green building, including programs like LEED certification, solar houses, zero energy, passive solar, Energy Star, and the like. On average, these programs are saving about 15 to 30% of the energy used in a typical building, but they account for only about 2% of new construction, which is itself only 1% to 2% of total buildings. This is far too little, too late. We think we can make a bigger impact by retrofitting the existing 90 million residential buildings in the U.S. and 5 million commercial buildings. And there's a lot of innovative strategies available, most of these, of course, revolving around increasing the thickness of building shells, increasing the efficiency of appliances, of course, most easily done by getting rid of them altogether, and better habits in our homes, like being more temperature flexible, another way of saying suck it up. Now, Community Solution has several model home retrofit programs underway at the moment as we're trying to determine the most energy-efficient structural and lifestyle changes to reducing home energy use, the number one use of energy for us. Yet so entrenched is our growth-oriented society that all we can focus on is applying these great innovations in building to new buildings rather than making what we have more energy-efficient. So we hear this incredible notion that we can consume more to consume less. Now, similarly, with transportation, we're putting all of our effort and our hope into making cars more efficient especially new cars. Well, hybrid cars have been on the market for about 10 years now, and we have 1 million of them on the roads. But this is in a world of 750 million vehicles, and in a world where 75 million new vehicles are manufactured and added to the roads each year. And, of course, we're told next will come pluggable hybrids, fuel cell cars, electric vehicles, and the like. And, of course, if these don't materialize, we'll just fill our cars with biofuels. Well, thankfully, we spent a lot of time today looking at how disastrous that change would be. So at some point, I think in America, we need to admit that the personal car was a huge mistake. It devoured the planet's most valuable finite energy resource. We need to look for ways to reduce the number of cars on the road and make transportation itself, not just cars, more efficient. We have a plan to use existing vehicles and current cell phone technology to start a ride-sharing system we call the Smart Jitney, which aims to increase vehicle ridership from the current 1.5 persons per vehicle to somewhere closer to 4 or 5. Now, unfortunately, in the short term, cars are the only viable transportation for our extremely decentralized automobile-dependent infrastructure. But of course, in the long run, revamping local and regional economies, living, working, and shopping in the same area will be able to utilize the more sustainable options of walking, bicycling, and mass transit. And finally, food. In a way, our food system can be seen as a metaphor for our entire industrial system, that of complete disconnection from nature and life. Before the industrial era, the agricultural system was still unsustainable. We robbed nutrients from the soil and disrupted the resilience of ecosystems. But fossil fuels allowed us to raise our level of destruction to unprecedented levels. Consider the fact that more land was converted to agriculture in the year 1945 than all of the 18th and 19th centuries combined. Today, our ridiculously inefficient system relies upon 10 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce just 1 calorie of food energy. And it gets worse for grain-fed livestock and manufactured foods, where 16 calories are needed to produce 1 calorie of meat, and 30 calories are needed to produce 1 calorie of soda. Now, a first step on the production side has to be to stop using so many fossil fuels, and there's a lot of work done there. But this requires not only how we grow food, but what we grow. In the U.S. today, 85% of the cultivated area is devoted to 4 crops, corn, hay, soybeans, and wheat, most of which is fed to livestock or used in manufactured food products, which of course have inferior nutritional content. The other most energy-intensive food is grain-fed livestock. Now, a recent report from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization entitled Livestock's Long Shadow revealed that more CO2 equivalent is generated from livestock production than from all of transportation. And this is why dietary change is so incredibly important. First of all, we're over-consuming food just like we're over-consuming energy, water, and so many other resources. On average, we're over-consuming food by a third in the United States. And of course, we have two-thirds of our population now that is overweight or obese. Secondly, we're consuming far too much meat. The average person in the world now consumes three times the amount of meat as they did in 1960, with the global north consuming three times the amount of meat as the global south. And finally, we're consuming too much highly processed food and not enough fresh fruits, vegetables, beans, nuts, and whole grains. These healthy crops comprise only 3.2% of the total farmland of the U.S. Fruits and vegetables account for only 5% of the American diet. Half of that is potatoes, no doubt in the form of French fries. So beyond a more sustainable agriculture that uses less fossil fuels and dietary changes to consume less energy-intensive foods, it's very important that we all take responsibility of where our food comes from. We're the only animals, besides baby animals, that don't do anything to procure our food. In the U.S. today, 2% of our population are farmers. This has to change. When we shift to using far fewer fossil fuels and start to rebuild and repair the damaged soil and, of course, grow more real food, we'll need vastly more human labor to do it. This includes full-time farmers for sure, but it involves all of us producing some food, and really that's the most efficient, secure, and sustainable agriculture system that we can conceive of. Now, this is actually a wonderful thing because more people being engaged in food production can have a truly transformative effect on our culture. Agrarian discrimination is quite prevalent in our society. Some of the words we use to talk about farmers include provincial, unsophisticated, hayseeds, bumpkins, yokels, hicks, peasants, hillbillies, country cousins, rednecks, clodhoppers, of course, doing back-breaking, mind-numbing labor. Farmers of the future must be respected above all, for theirs is the work of healing the earth from their industrial destruction, restoring the integrity of natural systems, repairing and renewing our long-damaged relationship with nature, and creating a new way of inhabiting the planet. So as we curtail our use of fossil fuels, contributing less and less to this destructive global industrial system, we must begin to contribute more and more to its alternative, which we describe as small local community. Small, of course, refers to a more realistic scale of human habitation, which is, of course, less centralized, operating more as a web of interconnections between people, allowing more meaningful relationships to develop. Local refers to the necessity of being in close proximity with those whom you have economic relations, which is very important. Part of the reason that we can allow and actually contribute to this global ecological genocide of our planet and to the growing misery of the world's poor through our daily economic decisions is that we're separated from this reality by so much distance. Everything and everyone who provides us what we need to survive is an abstraction. We consume brand names, not resources and people. If we could see the sweatshop workers and the falling forests, we could not morally continue to treat them as we complete disregard for their well-being. So in redeveloping more face-to-face economic relationships, we will come to have respect for those who provide our necessities by making sure they have a fair wage and safe working conditions, for example. In turn, they will make sure that our health and safety is provided for. This mutual relationship serves to improve everyone's well-being, including the well-being of nature, not just corporate profit. In this way, individuals and communities can have greater control over their destiny. Rather than being at the mercy of global oil prices and other commodity prices, corrupt CEOs and inept public officials. Everywhere you hear people losing confidence in this crumbling global economic system, but most people don't have an alternative. They don't have a community that can care for their needs. But community is the real source of security. And peak oil, combined with resource depletion, global warming, and the emerging financial crisis, when these strike home, I think more and more people will begin to realize this. So what can we do? Well, we can certainly blame other people for the problems in which we find ourselves, and that may make us feel better temporarily. But in reality, it is us, the billion or so overconsumptive middle-class people on this planet that are the greatest perpetrators of global destruction, not the small number of elite consumers or the destitute and mostly self-reliant majority. So we are the problem, but we are the solution as well. The changes we make in our own lives can have more of an impact on global resource use than entire communities in other parts of the world. Consider the fact that the average American uses more energy just for their personal food consumption than the average person in the global South is consuming in total. So how do we begin to make these personal lifestyle changes, and how do we sustain them into the future? Well, we got into this situation one bad decision at a time, and we'll get out of it one good decision at a time. But we need to realize that if we don't choose, then choices will be made for us. So we here in this hall, who are much further in our level of understanding of the problem and of the false solutions being promoted, have an obligation to take action. We certainly should do all we can to teach and share the truths of this global crisis with everyone we know, but we also have to use this head start, this precious time that we have now before the crisis, to really begin to build our new community economies, to revive and strengthen our local connections, which will prove to be invaluable in a time of crisis. Together, we are pioneering a new low-energy future, and more than anything, we need new models of how it can succeed. Community Solution has a plan and land for a model neighborhood community called Agraria that we intend to build in our town of Yellow Springs, Ohio. It will consist of very small, passive houses, meaning designed so they don't need heating or cooling systems, plus gardens which will provide much of the food of the neighborhood, and will be based upon interdependent social and economic relationships both within the neighborhood and within the greater community. Most importantly, we envision this as the educational and cultural transformation center of our small town of 3,700. So we need examples of what's possible, and we need examples at all levels, at the local level, at the individual level, and also at the national and global level. And one very powerful example at the national level is Cuba. When the Soviet Union, Cuba's oil lifeline, collapsed in the early 1990s, Cuba lost half their oil overnight. In just a few years, they made the transition from being one of the most industrialized countries in Latin America to being one of the most sustainable in the world. While consuming one-eighth the energy of the average American, Cubans now have the same lifespan, a lower infant mortality rate, and then more teachers and doctors per capita than the United States. Today, 80% of Cuba's agricultural production is organic. The cities provide for most of their vegetable needs within the limits, and Cubans are decentralizing their energy generation systems and developing more efficient mass transit. Many of these and other developments are documented in our film, The Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil. And really, the real lesson that Cuba provides us is not what they did, but how they did it. When the crisis hit, the Cubans didn't hope for someone to save them, even their own government. They took the initiative in their communities and survived, revitalizing exchange at the local levels as they transitioned to a much more agrarian, land-based economy. And this is how I believe the change will take place, not from above, but from within, from individuals and communities and eventually entire nations pioneering a better way to live on this planet, planting the seeds of a more sustainable future. I want to end with a quote from Henry David Thoreau. "Though I do not believe that a plant will spring up where there no seed has been planted, I have faith in a seed. Convince me that you have a seed there, and I am prepared to expect wonders." Well, I'm prepared to expect wonders from this crowd tonight. So please rise to that challenge. Thank you.
Megan Quinn Bachman of Community Solution in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Richard Heinberg. He's the author of 6 books, including The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World, and The Oil Depletion Protocol, A Plan to Avert Oil Wars. He's a journalist, educator, editor, lecturer, and core faculty member at the New College of California, where he teaches courses on energy and society and culture, ecology, and sustainable community. Richard is the foremost peak oil educator in the world, and we are honored to have him with us tonight. Please welcome Richard.
Good. Thanks very much. Well, this I'm afraid, is going to be more of a problem presentation than a solution presentation. But the problem at hand is one that perhaps hasn't been discussed as much so far. I have to confess, I just arrived a few minutes ago, got up at 2 a.m., was driven by a fossil fuel taxi to a fossil fuel bus to a fossil fuel plane to get me here. And then when I got to my hotel, I walked from there to the conference, so that was as much as I could do. But so I'm at a bit of a disadvantage in not knowing exactly what's been discussed so far. But I want to make sure that what I'm about to tell you is part of the conversation, is part of the mix, because unless it is, I'm afraid something important is being missed. Whether we're talking about climate change or peak oil, we're really talking about energy. And energy is a fundamental to life itself. We're energy junkies, all of us. In fact, all organisms are. And it's been our particular genius as humans to find ways of harvesting more energy from our environment than would be the case if we didn't have language and tools. Next slide. All of human history really can be understood as a series of energy watersheds, starting with harnessing of fire and then agriculture, which was a way of taking over more productivity from the ecosystems around us, basically taking over more energy, more solar sunlight energy. And when we found fossil fuels and began using them a couple of hundred years ago, it was as though we had found a treasure chest of energy that had been created over millions of years, gradually stored and concentrated, and it was like nothing else in previous human history. And one simple measure of that is just population. It's well known that our human population was fewer than 1 billion at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And through the application of fossil fuels to agriculture and transportation and public health and all sorts of things, we've managed to increase our numbers up to over 6.5 billion today. I sometimes catch myself saying 6 billion, but we're way beyond that. Just since 1999, we've added more than the equivalent of the population of North America. So this is biological success by any standard, but it's a perilous kind of success because it relies on a kind of phantom carrying capacity created by fossil fuels, which compose about 85% of world energy currently, with petroleum as number one. Coal has moved back into the number two slot, and natural gas number three. Next slide. Now, I'm going to speak for a few minutes about the subject of peak oil. I know that probably many of you already know the basics, but I think it's important to cover those basics to make sure we're all on the same page. The essential concept is that we really shouldn't be considering when fossil fuels actually run out, particularly oil, because that's not the problem. The problem is that at some point we will reach a maximum rate of extraction, and from there on it will all be downhill. And we know that will happen because we've seen it in individual oil fields and whole oil-producing countries. These are four oil fields, two in Russia, two in the U.S., and as you can see, oil production profiles over time can take any number of shapes, but they always start at zero and end at zero, and there's some kind of peak in between, usually at about the halfway point. Next slide, please. This is a graph of global oil discoveries, which, as you can see, peaked right around 1964. So we haven't been finding as much oil in recent years, and it's not for lack of trying, and it's not just a couple of years of bad luck. This is a long-term, well-established trend. Next slide. Now let's see what happened in the U.S. when global oil discoveries peaked, as they did back in 1930. 40 years later, in 1970, U.S. oil production peaked, and that's significant because the U.S. at that time was the world's foremost oil-producing nation. In fact, in the early 20th century, America was the foremost oil-exporting nation. It's hard for us to even grasp that now because, of course, we're living in a world where the U.S. imports two-thirds of what it uses, but America used to be the Saudi Arabia of the early 20th century. That's the power of depletion. And so the U.S. is living in a post-peak environment, has been since since 35 years ago. Now, what happened when U.S. oil production peaked? Well, we applied technology. We started looking for more oil, and both strategies succeeded. We found two enormous new oil-producing provinces, North Slope of Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico. We applied water flooding of oil fields, gas flooding of fields. We started organizing stripper wells and so on. And all of that worked, as you can see. U.S. oil production actually has not declined as fast as it otherwise would have. However, it's still declining. And those efforts like discovering more oil and using more technology are exactly what the oil industry is proposing to avert or delay global oil production peak, which is, again, happening not just in the U.S., but in country after country, in the North Sea. Great Britain just recently became a net oil importer again after a couple of decades of economic miracle from oil from the North Sea. And this is a widespread trend. Every year there are fewer countries in the category of oil exporters and more countries in the category of oil importers. So altogether, of all of the significant oil-producing nations, a majority now are past their all-time production peaks. A few of these countries may still be able to increase their production, such as Iraq. There's every possibility that that country, with a stable political climate and so on, could increase its production. But for most of these countries, we're talking about a state of terminal decline next. So this is as succinct a definition of peak oil as I've seen. It's not a matter of totaling up how much oil is left in the world, because there's an enormous amount of stuff that either is liquid petroleum or could theoretically be turned into liquid petroleum. The question is, at what rate? At what point will additions to supply be unable to make up for declines in supply? Well, at what point? How close are we? It looks like we're pretty damn close. This is the situation. We saw the peak month of production for regular conventional oil so far in May 2005. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but the price of oil is pretty damn high these days. It hit $80 this week. We're at nominal record prices for oil, and yet the world isn't producing anymore. What's going on here? There's every motive for oil-producing nations to bring as much to market as they possibly can, and we seem to be stuck in neutral. Well, the overwhelming likelihood is that the world has hit the plateau immediately prior to the actual global oil production peak, and beginning around 2010 or so, we will begin to see declines in the nature of 1-2% per year, which will grow after 2015 to about 3% per year, and after 2025 to about 4 or 5% per year. Well, that's significant given the fact that we're overwhelmingly dependent on oil for transportation and agriculture. But there's more to it than that. All oil exporting nations are also oil consumers. And what a country like the United States really is interested in is not so much the total amount of oil being consumed in the world, but the amount that's available on the export market, because we want to import a lot of that, as do many, many other nations. Well, as prices for oil increase, that also increases revenues to oil-producing nations and oil, especially oil-exporting nations, so their economies grow. What do they do with that economic growth? Well, people buy more cars, drive more, and so on, so their oil consumption is increasing, which means that the amount available for export is decreasing faster than the decline in total global production. And that rate of decline of available exports is likely to be very steep indeed over the years ahead. Next slide. Now, it's going to be hard for me to recite this from memory, and I'm not sure I can read it from this angle, but maybe you can just read it for yourselves. The International Energy Agency, headquartered in Paris, which was set up in the 1970s to warn of future oil shocks, has generally been pretty complacent about this whole subject of oil depletion until just recently. And now the IEA is really starting to sound very frightened indeed. And I think for good reason. I would say they're finally starting to do their job. Next slide. So how serious a problem is all of this? I mean, we might say, well, it sounds pretty good, actually. I mean, if oil is and the other fossil fuels are such a problem in terms of global climate change, well, if there's less there and depletion alone requires us to cut back, well, isn't that a good thing? Well, yes, up to a point it is. And at the same time, who's prepared for this? What country on earth is prepared for $100, $150, $200 a barrel oil? I don't think any of us are, in fact. Certainly not the United States. A study was done for the U.S. Department of Energy a couple of years ago called Peaking of World Oil Production, Impacts, Mitigation, and Risk Management. The authors of the study didn't try to estimate when the global peak would occur. They just were tasked with figuring out if this was, in fact, going to be a big deal or another sort of Y2K. The report they came back with, a 100-page report, had this as the first paragraph of its executive summary. Essentially, they said, unless industrialized nations like the United States start about 20 years ahead of the peak to prepare for it, at a crash program scale of effort, the result is going to be what the authors call unprecedented impacts, social, economic, and political impacts. And when they say unprecedented, implicitly they're saying this is more serious than the Great Depression or World War II. Next slide. Now, the situation is not limited to oil. Natural gas and coal are also finite fossil fuels. Now, the global situation with natural gas is not so well known, not so well studied as is the case with oil. However, regional natural gas shortages and declines are already developing, certainly in North America. Back in 1990, the average new natural gas well depleted 17% in the first year. Today, the average new natural gas well depletes 32%, one-third, in the first year. So we're finding smaller wells. So we have to find more in order to just tread water, which means we're at record drilling rates, and the amount of natural gas coming to market in North America is declining. We're on the verge of a natural gas crisis, a natural gas cataclysm, in fact, because we're dependent on natural gas for home heating, for producing fertilizer for farmers, for chemicals, plastics. And most of the chemicals and plastics industries have moved offshore already because North American natural gas is already so expensive. So natural gas is certainly not going to come to the rescue. It's not a solution to the oil problem. It's another problem in and of itself. Next slide. How about coal? Well, the conventional wisdom is that the world has 200, 250 years worth of coal. That's what's called a reserve to production ratio. In other words, you just divide the total resource base by the yearly consumption and you get some figure, 200 years. Well, if we continue using coal at current rates, that'll last for 200 years. Reserve to production ratios always lie. Always, without exception. Because it assumes that we're going to continue using the resource at a constant rate, which we never do, and then one Tuesday afternoon, 200 years from now, suddenly it'll all run out. Of course, that's not going to happen. What we need to do are peaking studies. When are we going to reach peak coal production globally? Well, a study was just done in Germany by the Energy Watch Group, which reports to the German Parliament, looking at the most recent reserves figures for coal globally, and found, astonishingly enough, that global coal production is probably going to peak in about 15 years. In China, much sooner, Now, of course, China is by far the world's greatest coal consumer, and China's been relying on coal primarily for its economic growth, as the energy source for its economic growth. What's this going to mean for China? Next slide. We'll add all of these together. This is all fossil fuels. This is our future, folks. All energy from fossil fuels total peaks around 2010 and declines gradually for the first couple of decades and then much more rapidly after that. Again, who's ready for this? What industrial economy is prepared for this? Next slide. Sources that supply 85% of current world energy are set to decline, starting perhaps as soon as 5 years from now. Do we have a plan B? Do we have a suite of alternative energy sources just waiting in the wings to grow quickly enough to make up for these declines? The answer, unfortunately, is absolutely not. One can talk theoretically about how much solar energy could be produced in the Sahara Desert and so on, but the trillions of dollars of investment capital that would be required for schemes like that are nowhere to be seen at this point. In fact, we're simply going down the well-trodden path of Plan A to energy Armageddon. And the path that our national leaders in this country are on is simply one of last one standing. We will use our military to try to gain access to whatever fuel supplies we need, even though experience is showing that it doesn't work. Okay, I'm going to cut to the chase. Next slide. Clearly, the energy transition away from fossil fuels is the central theme for the coming century. Whether we do it motivated by the exigencies of climate change, or we're forced into it by shortage created by peak oil, peak gas, and peak coal, the result is going to be the same. If the 20th century was all about economic growth and growth in per capita energy consumption and growth in fossil fuel consumption, the 21st century is going to be just the opposite. One way or the other, like it or not, plan for it or not. The reality right now is that it's not rich industrial nations that are cutting back. It's in fact the poorest nations that are cutting back on fossil fuel consumption because they can't afford it. I was at the UN last week speaking at the DPI gathering of all the NGOs and met an amazing young woman from Zambia who's organizing local farmers to give up conventional agriculture and adopt more traditional and natural and organic agricultural methods. And she told me how farmers in her region are, so many of them are still trying to apply the industrial agricultural techniques that have been recommended to them by all of the government agencies and international agricultural corporations and so on. And they're failing because they can't afford the pesticides and the herbicides and the fertilizers. It's happening in country after country. So fossil fuel depletion really adds another element to the whole conversation. It's not just a matter of cutting back on fossil fuel consumption to avert catastrophic climate change. It's also necessary to do so in order to reduce vulnerability to skyrocketing prices for fuels and also vulnerability to oil wars and invasion for the takeover of remaining fossil fuel supplies. I don't have time to propose any solutions to you right now, except to say in a very general way, I think we have to plan this century. to relocalize our economies, to turn the movie of globalization in reverse, because globalization was always based on cheap transportation fuel. And this may be even a little more radical. I think we're going to have to plan to de-industrialize our economies. This is not just a matter of transferring renewable energy technologies to the less industrialized countries. That certainly needs to happen. But also to de-industrialize the currently industrialized economies and to do so as rapidly and systematically as possible. That, I think, is our only survival strategy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. Our next speaker is going to be presenting via DVD, and it's Rob Hopkins. Rob is focused on looking at how communities can prepare for climate change and the end of cheap oil, which Richard discussed. He's the founder of the Transition Towns movement that's sweeping across the UK, a very powerful movement, and the founder of the first one, which was Transition Town Totness. He is also researching a PhD at Plymouth University. He's a teacher of permaculture and practical sustainability for 10 years. And he didn't come live to this conference because of the environmental impact of flying across the ocean. So we very much appreciate that, that he could still participate. It's very admirable. So here he is.
Thank you very much for the invitation to address this conference here today. Very honoured to be able to speak to the IFG conference. I hope you will understand my reasons why I'm not there in person, much as I would like to be, but I took the pledge a year and a half ago to no longer fly, and I take that very seriously. And when investigating for this presentation, I found out that actually if I came on the plane, I would use about 2,788 pounds of carbon just to be there with you today, which in the new scenario of having to live within our carbon footprint is actually more than a year's entitlement of carbon. So that's why I'm not coming and to be with you there today. And I hope that you'll enjoy this presentation delivered in this different way, and that maybe it might inspire other people to consider doing presentations in a similar way also. What I want to talk to you about today is about the transition movement and about the concept of resilience. I won't be talking about peak oil because you will have already heard that from Richard Heinberg and other people. But I want to, just my tuppence worth on peak oil is that, you know, there's a belief sometimes put out that when oil hits a certain price that everything is just going to unravel and that we're going to see a kind of societal breakdown and societal collapse. I think that the same ingenuity, creativity, and adaptability that got us up to the top of that peak in the first place can get us back down the other side. There's no reason why everything has to completely unravel when we hit that point. And for me, a very useful way of looking at it is this, which was produced by Bryn Davidson of the Dynamic Cities Project, which I think sets out very well the challenges that we have. If we have slow depletion or fast depletion along this line, or proactive responses or reactive responses along the vertical axis. So if we have slow depletion and we don't do anything, then likelihood is that we lurch slowly into a business-as-usual climate chaos, kind of slow meltdown. If we have a very rapid depletion and we've done nothing to prepare for it, then the outcome is likely sort of collapse, complete breakdown of everything because we're so vulnerable to it. If we have a very rapid reaction and we have slow depletion, then maybe we can develop what we term sustainable development. But actually, I would argue that given the rapid unfolding of oil depletion and the fact that we need to really respond very, very quickly, our likelihood is that we end up with what we call power down, sort of lean economy, more localized way of looking at things, which is what I shall go on to talk about. Now, I think that in many ways preparing for the the converging of peak oil and climate change, you know, what that gives us is the biggest challenge really humanity has ever faced, and that we stand on the verge of having to deal with those two challenges completely ill-prepared, that the tools that we've had as environmentalists for the last 30, 40, 50 years are inadequate for the job. Just protesting, campaigning, lobbying are insufficient for really what we have to do to scale up for this challenge. And the way I like to think of it is, if you want to persuade a very reluctant friend to join you on a holiday, you need to paint a beautiful picture of this lovely taverna by the sea where you can see the sun going down and you can lie on the beach and they do a lovely paella, whereas actually what we tend to do is to paint a picture of a fairly miserable, seedy bed and breakfast somewhere in on the south coast of England with nylon sheets and where the toast is all soggy, and you know we paint a miserable picture of somewhere really quite wretched and then try and persuade people that they really, really don't want to go there. I think the psychology is all the wrong way round. What we need to be doing is painting a very powerful vision, attractive picture of where we want to go, so that people can engage in this, which is the greatest sort of collective adventure of our times. Lester Brown talks about a wartime mobilization. You know, we have to think very differently in order to create that, I think. And certainly here in the UK and in the US, I'm sure as well, the Achilles heel really is transportation. You know, in the UK we have 30 million cars on the road, we have however million lorries, just-in-time centralized distribution systems, incredibly reliant on cheap liquid fuels. And if we were to run them all on biodiesel in the UK, we'd need four times the arable landmass of the UK just growing biodiesel. If we wanted to run them on nuclear power, we'd need to build 64 new nuclear power stations. You know, it's really our Achilles heel. And once you start to take the liquid fuels out or they become unaffordable, what you have to fall back on is what you have around you. And David Fleming, the economist, writes that localization stands at best at the limits of practical possibility, but it has the decisive argument in its favour that there will be no alternative. And really, what we're looking at in the transition movement is, how can we start to rebuild what we need to fall back on, that localised infrastructure? And we use the term resilience to describe that, which is the ability of a community or a settlement to withstand shock from the outside. And if we go back in this area of Devon, where I'm speaking to you from in southwest of England, back as far as the 1850s, before the railways came, this whole area was pretty much self-sufficient for its basic needs, its food, its building materials, its fabrics, and so on. It would all be produced locally. Most of the fresh fruit and vegetables were produced within or on the margins of the town. The meat and the dairy were produced within the sort of hinterland of the town. I like to use the analogy of it being like a cake, in that at that point, the cake was produced locally. What was brought into Totnes in the sailboats running up the river was the icing and the cherry on the cake. If those boats stopped coming, we were fine and we could manage. Now we're completely the other way around. The cake is sourced globally wherever it can be found cheapest, and what local agriculture produces is really the icing and the cherry on the top of the cake. And given the impending nature of climate change and peak oil, we have to reverse that very, very rapidly, I think. So when we're looking at this idea of resilience, you know, what things add resilience, what things don't? Well, if we have local composting, which is producing compost for local agriculture, that's adding resilience. If we have centralised recycling, where we're collecting together all our plastics, sending them off to Newcastle, it doesn't add any resilience to the local economy. If we're planting trees within our urban framework, we can be planting productive trees wherever we can, is building resilience. Planting ornamental trees just for the sake of it isn't really building any resilience. And I think in the UK, with the Millennium Forests thing that we had, where millions of trees were planted over the UK to mark the millennium, we missed out on a huge opportunity there to plant food forests to really be building some of that resilience. If we use local building materials built to high modern specifications, we can be building whole new markets there in terms of making clay plasters, cob blocks, hemp materials and so on. Whereas if we just import green building materials from wherever we can find them around the world, it doesn't actually add very much resilience to the local economy. And this idea of resilience isn't something that is a new idea. You know, this area, this part of England, in the town of Totnes where I live, up until the 1930s, every shop in the town was owned by local people. There was urban agriculture within the town. A man called George Heath and three other people had commercial market gardens within the fabric of the town, which appear on old maps of Totnes going back as far as there are maps as arable land. You know, we talk about nowadays the need to reduce food miles. We had a system of food feet then. He had glass greenhouses within the urban fabric, and then, but from his glasshouses you could actually see his shop on the high street. So all those things were in place until 1980 here, and have been dismantled. If we look at Cuba, what happened in Cuba when they experienced peak oil? They had to build that resilience very, very quickly. So they put in place incredible urban agriculture within Havana City and all over Cuba. Nowadays in the UK, we only really can see that old resilient economy in the street names of the places. As James Kunstler is fond of saying, we now name modern developments largely after what was bulldozed to make way for them. So we can walk down Orchard Lane, up Nursery Hill, down Walnut Parade or whatever, and get a sense of what we've lost and what we need to rebuild, really. So the work that I do, I've been teaching permaculture for the last 10 years, and for the last couple of years when I was in Ireland, I was teaching on the first two-year full-time permaculture course in the world at Kinsale Further Education College. And the last year of that course, we found out about peak oil. And that triggered a project that we designed with the students where we got them looking at the town of Kinsale and how it might make the transition from where it is now to where it would need to be, based on the idea that the future with less oil could be preferable to the present if we can engage sufficiently in advance with enough imagination, creativity, adaptability, and a scale of engagement that we've never really managed before. So what we produced out of that process was a thing called the Kinsale Energy Descent Action Plan, which was a 20-year plan that started out with vision for how the town could be and then backcast from there. And it was really just done as a student project. But after it was produced, it sold out all the printed copies. It's been downloaded about 4,500 times all around the world. It was endorsed by Kinsale Town Council, and it's become a very influential document. And it really inspired and underpinned the work that we now do in Totnes in Devon. So I want to tell you the story, really, of Transition Town Totnes, which is the initiative that I'm involved in here. Transition Town Totnes began in September 2005, and the very first year we just did awareness raising. We didn't rush in and start trying to do things. It was very much trying to raise awareness about peak oil and climate change, showing films like The End of Suburbia, The Power of Community, doing lots of talks, but also trying to do those talks not and film screenings not just in such a way where you present people with desperately depressing information and then leave them to it. I think we have a big responsibility that when we present this information, we allow people space to digest it, so they can you don't give someone a copy of At the End of Suburbia to watch on their own at home in a darkened room with nobody else present. You know, we have a responsibility for it to be a two-way process and start to be building the networks, which we did for the first year. Then we held in September 2006 something that we called the Official Unleashing of Transition Town Totnes, which was designed to be the evening historically that people would look back to as the point when the whole thing began. We had over 400 people came, the mayor introduced it, and it really created a lot of momentum which has driven the project forward ever since and created that sense of history that the whole process still has. So I wanted to talk about some of the things that we've done in that intervening year since we unleashed. One of the things that we use a lot is a tool called open space technology, which some of you may be familiar with, which is a very good way of bringing large groups of people together to completely self-organize discussions around different subjects. So we've run those on food, housing and building, energy, psychology of change, the arts, and economics. So we bring a lot of people together for that. It flushes out all the people in the community who are really passionate about that subject, and is a way that they can all generate those ideas. We upload the ideas that come from that live onto the website, and they've been a very, very useful exercise. If you're a control freak, organising open space is terrifying because it's so self-organising, but we found it to be a fantastic and very useful tool. We started collecting a number of oral histories from people all over the town, of their memories of life before cheap oil. And it's, I think it's something for those of us who were born in the 60s and on and beyond, who have no first-hand memory of life before cheap oil, it's very hard to really look back to that with any sense of it being a real thing. Whereas talking to people who lived through the 1930s and 40s here, particularly when petrol rationing was introduced, gives lots of insights into how the local economy worked, what skills people had, how people worked together and related to each other, which I think are very relevant. That's obviously not to romanticise the past and say we need to go back to it, but there is a lot we can learn from that. Having Schumacher College on our doorstep has enabled us to have access to some amazing speakers, some of whom are there with you today, Jerry Mander, Helena Norberg-Hodge, Richard Heinberg, a whole range of people who've been part of our speaking program, which has really helped to raise awareness on a lot of these issues.